Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Coach Podcast with me, your host, Teresa Brooks. And on this podcast, I like to bring you a variety of coaches and experts who have a wide-reaching range of subjects, topics, and expertise. And today's guest is no different. In fact, I hope you are tuned in for this one because it's going to be very, very interesting. And I would love to welcome to the podcast Sassy Smith. Now, Sassy is, she names herself as the Aphantasia Coach, and she's founder of the Aphantasia Coaching Academy. And if your eye has been drawn to this podcast and you're listening to it, then I think that's probably because you know what it is. But if it's just out of pure curiosity, then you're going to be in for quite an interesting podcast here. So, as the founder of Aphantasia, Sassy is a person who lives with this, and she's going to explain what this is, where it comes from, how you can work with it. And it's, she's got a very powerful story of self-discovery as well. And her particular focus is to create a space for neurodivergent people to experience transformational coaching. And this is her mission. And so we're going to be diving into this. But without further ado, let me say hello and welcome to the podcast, Sassy.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me. This is been looking forward to this one.
Yeah, it's great. We had a great conversation, didn't we, some time ago, which if we had just recorded that for the podcast would have been wonderful. But we're gonna try and recreate it for you anyway. So let's just dive straight in here as well and just ask, because this is the question on everybody's lips, what is aphantasia, Sassy?
So it's the inability to create mental images on demand. So it's for those of us that have it, and there are, I should say, there's many different ways of saying it. There's aphantasia, aphantasia, and another one that is slightly more Americanized. I tend to lean towards either aphantasia or aphantasia, so you might hear me say both throughout this, but it's the inability to visualize, basically. So we have no conscious ability to produce images in our mind at will. And that's really important, the at will and the conscious bit of it, because subconsciously, or and when sleeping, people with aphantasia can create visual images in their minds because we can dream visually. But it's the ability to do it on demand, really, is the key
Okay.
there.
Interesting. And where did the word come from? I'm sensing some kind of Latin or Greek. What does it actually mean? What does it mean?
So a is without, and fantasia is imagination, or it's latterly been changed to imagination. So it suggests that we don't have an imagination, which is not true. We have imaginations, it's just that they don't come with pictures. And fantasia is a scale. So you have people who have aphantasia at the bottom, who have no visual images, and then right at the very top are the people who are hyperphants, have hyperphantasia. And their visual imagery is so real that it could almost feel like you're actually looking at something. And then you go right over the top into maladaptive dreaming, which is a whole other area.
Wow. Okay, so what I'm hearing you saying is that it's not just like this is how it is. There's a whole scale, as we might expect, of how people will experience this individually. It sounds to me like being on either end of that scale could be quite agonizing. But talk to me about the difficulties that present at either end of that scale.
Yeah, so certainly from the bottom end of the scale, there's all sorts of challenges that can come with it. For most people who, like me, were born with it, so I should probably just say at this point that you can aphantasia can be congenital. You can be born with it. It can be acquired as a result of injury, head trauma, surgery. There's been some incident of it being linked to operations, and whether that's something that happens in the brain while somebody is having their operation, or whether it's linked to something chemical, we don't really know. But also through dissociation, so people can, you know, switch off that ability. So for me,
it's potentially connected with trauma as well.
Yeah.
So is there scientific research around that being born with it? That's interesting.
Yeah. So the just to sort of answer the first one, and then I'll question, then I'll come on to the research. So because I was born with it, because I have congenital aphantasia, I would really struggle to say whether it's impacted massively on my life.
Of course, because you've got no frame of reference, different. Do you?
Exactly. But what I do know is that my experience of being in situations where you need to be able to visualize, when you are doing visual exercises, I understand that nowadays lots of children are taught to do maths through seeing a blackboard and working the maths out in their head visually, which of course I wouldn't be able to do, and children who have aphantasia wouldn't be able to do. But for me, you know, when I was doing maths at school, they wanted to see our longhand working out, so it wasn't an issue for me because everything was on paper anyway. But it can.
But we're old enough, everyone that's listening, to know what longhand math means.
Yes.
Yeah, we're Gen X's here. Yeah.
Yeah, older than Google, and we still know what longhand math is.
Yeah. Yeah.
and so it was only sort of later in life that I realised that actually there were some areas of particularly personal development and coaching that I was struggling with, that I couldn't seem to get the same results as other people. And those were now, when I look back, were all those things that were very heavy on the visual side and everything that was kind of inner world as opposed to outer world.
So with that, can I just ask you a question? So with that, are you talking specifically about visualizations, meditations, picture this, can you imagine that kind of language where you're, and what happens to you when people say that to you? So if I said to you, Sassy, you know, can you imagine or picture or remember a time when you were at the beach, or what happens there?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things in there, because you use the phrase remember. And for a lot of people like me who have aphantasia, it also comes with a memory disorder.
Okay.
And that's severely deficient autobiographical memory, or SDAM or SDAM. So you can hear it said a number of ways. And so if you ask me to remember something, a time in my life where I did something, then chances are I wouldn't be able to recall a time. But you saying, can I imagine myself at a beach? Yes, I can imagine myself being at a beach. I live by the sea. I'm very blessed in that respect.
So because you know that experience,
I
can imagine that. You can put yourself there, but you couldn't remember. So you've been to the, you told me that you've been for a swim this morning.
Yes.
So if we were in a coaching session and I said to you, can you take yourself back to a time when you felt good having a swim?
Yeah.
And can you see yourself having a swim?
Yeah, so I would say, absolutely, I can take myself right back to this morning when I had a swim this morning. Can I see myself? No.
Right, okay.
But I can tell you about it, and I can tell you about that experience that I had this morning, but I can't recreate the memory. I can't recall the memory.
Picture yourself in the sea,
no,
in your costume, swimming. So, of course, that makes sense, doesn't it, that you would find the guided visualizations, certain processes, especially with sort of NLP and things like that, very, very tricky. So now that's an interesting point, because you said you were born with it, but when did you become aware of it? How did you discover you had it? 2015. Yeah. Wow, that's a long time.
Yeah. So it only got its name in 2015. And all my life, I've been a little bit of a science nerd, a bit geeky in that respect. I did all the sciences at school, and now I understand why, because I operate from very much in the left hemisphere of my brain. And one of the things that studies have shown that people with aphantasia, we are very much drawn to facts, figures, data, statistics. And lots of people with aphantasia tend to go into those kind of scientific, mathematic kind of based jobs.
Understandably so
enough.
As well, if that creative, visual, intuitive side is not so much operating, it makes sense, doesn't it, that would function in a higher way.
Absolutely so
you're a science geek.
I follow all of the science pages on Facebook, and I just happened to be reading one of them one morning, and this post came up from somebody who was talking about this new discovery, this new name for something called aphantasia. And I thought, well, I'll have a read of that one. And I was reading this person's experience of suddenly discovering that they couldn't visualize. And that actually, when people asked them to visualize, it wasn't just a concept, that there were people in the world actually creating images in their minds. And as I was reading that, I was like, sorry, did he just say that people can create images in their minds? Because it just kind
wow.
of, at that point, it was like, what? I'm sorry. I just thought, when you asked me to visualize myself at a beach, I just thought, that was just a concept. You know, if you ask me to visualize an apple, well, I could tell you what an apple is. I can, you know, I can describe an apple. I've eaten an apple, so I could probably describe what it tastes like. But the realization that people can actually not only create a 3D representation of an apple in their mind, but also recreate the taste of an apple, and, you know, the smell and all of those, and the textures, just
so it's not just the visuals,
mind.
It's the other senses
for
that
me
are part of it for you personally, and it's very interesting to me. And we had this conversation, like I say, referenced before, because this is something that I realized that I also suffer with, and when you said it in the way that you said it, and I knew about this before I met you.
Yeah.
And I also, if someone says to me anything that visual like that in the meditations, I couldn't understand. I was going through these meditations and nothing was happening.
Yeah.
Nothing was happening, because it's like, imagine yourself in a meadow. And every time I closed my eyes and tried to do that, it was just black.
Yeah.
It's just not there.
Yeah.
But of course I know what a meadow is like, because I walk through it every day. Of course I know my senses. So I would find myself straining to create something. And I realized what I was doing was I was thinking about the picture. I wasn't in the picture. So words like immerse yourself, and I was like, you sort of go through it. Now, I'm an NLP trainer, so I do a lot of work like that. Great results for other people. And I'm thinking, wow, that's amazing. And then when I would do it, I was thinking, not wow.
Exactly.
not wow. And so that was a very, very interesting thing, that, of course, you only know yourself, so you don't know what you don't know. So until you start getting a reference or some language on this, and maybe some people that are listening are having a bit of their own moment and testing out their own visuals or whatever's going on. But I realized it was a struggle. And because of that, I started to feel like, oh, I can't do this. Why don't all these amazing visualizations and meditations, why don't they take me anywhere?
Yeah.
I was okay with the audio, but you know, the ones that say, when you go down the steps, you're going down. Oh my goodness. The amount of time, Sassy, I was at the step, I was trying to go down the steps again. That's it. Finding the steps, visualizing the steps, trying to feel the steps under my feet.
Yep.
I was exhausted
before
I'd even got in, and it's supposed to be relaxing. So I realized that all this was going on quite some time ago. And I do know some other people that it affects as well, but it's such a revelation.
Yes.
When you realize something, and then you actually, like, how does it feel to you, Sassy, that other people can immerse themselves in those memories like that and actually be them again? Like, for me, that's alien. I don't know how that feels for you. I'd love to hear.
Yeah, I mean, it's the concept of being able to step into your memories or play a film of a wonderful day in your head to yourself is just
The movie stuff.
bonkers, absolutely bonkers. And you know, and so my husband and I, we have these conversations every now and then, and I'll say, so what does that actually feel like to you? You know, what does that, so when I try, and because he's at the top end, he's a hyper fant, so he can it has really rich, vivid visual world in his head, and actually projecting, so he can visually project.
What do you mean by that?
So for example, this was one of the conversations we had, funny enough, he said, well, sometimes at work, I'll have to work out if there is enough space to put something when we have a delivery come in. So he's a distribution and logistics manager for an outdoor company. And when the things come into the warehouse, sometimes he has to think about, am I going to be able to fit that in that space, you know, around the corner somewhere in the warehouse? And what he can do is he can look at a box, and then he can visually stack the boxes like five or six high, and look at that in relation to the space as with his eyes open looking at. And as he's thinking it, he's visualizing whether or not it would do it, but with his eyes open. And he's always right, he tells me. We've never tested
Incredible.
It, but he's always right, because he can visually work out how big it is. His internal and external spatial awareness is just so good, and it comes with all that visuals. And it's a
sounds like a lot of skills wrapped up in that, all in one, actually, but also that being able to create a reality in front of your eyes and sort of test that out, because that's the kind of thing where, you know, you get a piece of furniture home or whatever, you go, oh, this doesn't fit at all.
Yes.
Some people just don't have those skills, but they could imagine it there, but the size is smaller and it did fit in my mind. It did fit.
Yes.
So there's some nuances, isn't there, between, again, there's lots and lots of individualities.
Yes.
But why do you think this happens? You said you talk a little bit about the scientific research. You've mentioned sometimes, you know, operations or some quite big things.
Yeah.
And also cogenital, that you were born with it.
Yeah, yeah.
So how do you know you were born with it? Is that an actual diagnosis? How did you get to that realization?
So you can't, there's no formal diagnosis yet. There are some tests that you can do to see if you have aphantasia. So there's an online test that you can do, which is the VVIQ, the Vividness of Visual Imagery Questionnaire. If you just Google VVIQ, it'll come up. There's some research that's come out around how pupils react in certain circumstances when people are imagining and visualizing darkness and light that could potentially provide a clue that people have aphantasia. The research from that suggests that people who visualize, if they're visualizing being in the dark, their pupils dilate as if they are in the dark. But whereas people who are unable to do that visualization, pupils remain the same. So potentially there's a physical way of diagnosing at some point. But what some of the research is suggesting is that people who have congenital aphantasia are more likely to find that members of their family also have it. And that's definitely the case for me, that family members have that.
And they, I assume, didn't know that they had that either.
No, exactly.
It's
not
been quite the ripple of revelation for you all.
Talking. Yeah, not until we started talking about it, really. The research that started with the discovery of aphantasia. I say the discovery, and for those who aren't watching this, who are listening, I did speech bubbles then, marks then, was specifically relating to an architect who had gone in for an operation on his heart, and he had gone into that operation being able to very vividly visualize, to look at and rotate 3D images of properties in his head, plans and things, woke up from the operation unable to visualize.
Ooh.
And it was such a stark difference that this was where the research started. However, the first record of people not being able to visualize was in fact in 1880, and that was a little test that Sir Francis Galton did with some of his colleagues, where he asked them to visualize and then write down and recall what their breakfast plate that morning had looked like. And he asked 100 of his peers, and 12 of them had written that they were unable to do that. And I think he just kind of made a note of it, that it was interesting that there was 12 people who couldn't, and that was that, you know, forgotten about. And then in 1909, another George Herbert Betts looked at it and made some notes, but it kind of never went anywhere. So it was only when Professor Adam Zeman read about this architect who'd lost the ability to visualize that he started to take an interest in it. And it was Adam Zeman who came up with the name aphantasia.
I suppose in that situation, it's very clear that something's happened. That's exactly. Why, as opposed to, oh, I noticed that's interesting. Yeah. And it's like, where would the next step be? Yeah. There's a definite line with that story, isn't there? There's a before the operation and there's an after, and there's a stark difference. Do you know what part of the brain they say is affected by that study at all? No, don't worry if you don't, but just out of interest.
Yeah, so for him, it was something linking to the visual cortex and recall through the visual cortex, I think. I'm just trying to remember what it was for him. For those of us who've got the congenital, basically that what they've done is they've done some research where they've asked people to visually create a famous face in their head. And then they did some MRI scans at the same time. And what you can see is that the creative part of the brain, so the right hemisphere of the brain, certain areas of the right hemisphere are lighting up for people who are creating those images and not for those that aren't. And then those studies showing that those of us with aphantasia are just, everything's going on in the kind of the left-hand side of the brain.
So let's just do that for a minute, because anybody that's listening, join in, because it's a really interesting thing. So I just tried to visualize a famous face, one that I really like as well, just to help things along a bit. Well, okay, it was Tom Cruise. Okay, don't judge me. Right. And I know what he looks like. Yeah. Of course, you know, since I've been crushing since I was 12, so I know what he looks like. But I can't bring that in.
No.
I can't see that. I'm just looking at a plain office wall in front of me. So there's no distractions, but I can't get that. I can get parts of it. I'm thinking of like a reel or a picture. I'm remembering something that yeah. I've seen that will remind me of his face.
Yeah.
And I can see the smile. A certain bits are starting to come, but it doesn't just pop.
No.
No, it definitely doesn't pop, and it's almost like bits of a face, the smile, of course, and but I can't put it all together, and it doesn't just appear beautifully in my mind's eye. And I wonder how anybody else, if they're doing that exercise right now, it would be amazing to hear the responses of whoever they've pictured that's, you know, well known to them, anybody really.
Yeah.
What do you make of that, Sassy? So, what happens when you do it?
Yeah, so for me, I like to use this phrase that I will build it with words. So I you thinking about Tom Cruise, me thinking about Tom Cruise, I'm now building Tom Cruise's face with words. So that, again, that real link into the left-hand side of my brain, because I'm thinking my first thing would be, okay, so which Tom Cruise shall I think about? Are we doing a Mission Impossible Tom Cruise, or are we doing Top Gun Tom Cruise? So that was the first thing that happened. Was
right,
a little
interesting.
Conversation with myself about which one, and then I thought, well, if we're going for the Top Gun Tom Cruise, then he had, and now all I'm doing in my head is just describing him.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all I'm doing. I am.
But you need to create that for yourself from the information that you already have about said person.
Yeah.
So wide smile, cheeky look, this new
Yes.
skin,
Yeah. Yeah.
5'7", 6", whatever it is,
Two.
that kind of thing. So you are literally building a picture.
I build it with words. Yeah. For somebody, so that expression came from somebody who once said to me, "Well, how do you know?" So if I asked you to visualize a tree, how do you do that? And I said, well, the first thing I'd need to know is what tree would you like me to visualize? Because there are lots of
You need
them.
to know that. You need
Yeah.
to know that to be able to do it. You don't
Yeah,
just go
because pine
tree
tree,
in my mind.
yeah, pine tree is completely different to an apple tree. The leaves are completely different. And this is
Wow, that's
again,
so
this kind of
interesting.
logical side of my
Yeah.
brain immediately goes, yeah, but just like, what kind of tree do you need?
You can really notice there that the creativity side doesn't like pop its popcorn.
No.
Because so it's my experience there is if you said a tree, I would just create my own tree. Now I might not see it swinging and swaying in front of me, but I'll just create my own tree. That comes,
Yeah.
but in the same way as Tom, I'd have to like, yeah, okay, I need to just consider being in the park, seeing the tree. I need to do some stuff with it. It doesn't just like, and I don't know, does that happen for other people? I can't know. I mean, in your
No,
experience
exactly. And
working with people, do they, like your husband, would be like, the tree is right there, and I can see
yes.
the glints on the leaves and like the
Yes.
tones of the green, and I could almost reach out and I could almost touch the tree.
Yes.
He's
Yeah.
really there.
Yeah.
Yeah,
So
really.
when he
Okay.
remembers our wedding day, he can recall me walking down the aisle towards him as if it's happening, and he can re-experience all of those feelings. And I can factually tell you what time we got married, what he was wearing, what I was wearing, what I walked down the aisle to. Very factual things that happened of that day, but I cannot step into that memory. Or I can tell you the stories that I have of that day because I
Can
can
you
remember
feel that day?
stories. No,
Right,
no.
so you can't feel it. So is that part
No.
of this? Because now we're talking about feelings rather than
Yeah,
just visuals.
so there has been a link to that inability to feel emotions. And I have to be really, really clear about this, that this is not the same experience for everybody with aphantasia. I happen to have the full, whammy of all of the conditions that can occur with aphantasia. Some people just can't visualize, and that's it. Not most of us, but most of the people who have severely deficient autobiographical memory have aphantasia, but not everybody with aphantasia has SDAM. Not everybody who has aphantasia doesn't have an inner monologue. I don't have an inner monologue, so I don't have a stream of consciousness of thoughts that runs through my brain. They're there, but I don't hear them, for want of a better expression. But that's not the same for everybody. There are lots of people with aphantasia who talk about the fact that they're, it just doesn't shut up. Their inner voice doesn't shut up. But I can't actually access my inner voice. And not everybody has this inability to experience their or feel all of their emotions. And that's alexithymia. But there's a very much some evidence to support the fact that when people are recalling their memories and re-experiencing those emotions, it creates more capacity to feel those emotions. And so, because I don't experience that on a daily basis, I don't use my emotions very often. I described it like a tap. That every time somebody has a lovely memory of something, the tap turns on and it drips a little bit. It fills up their bucket with really nice emotions, and so it continues to fill up the bucket with my nice emotions, and my bucket never gets filled up unless I'm actually doing something that is producing those emotions. I'm in the moment with them. I don't get this continuous lovely drip of, things that happen because I don't step into and remember those feelings or feel them.
So you can enjoy, you can experience an emotion and a feeling in the moment, in the
Yes.
experience, and know
Yes.
that that was a positive feeling for you. And you can name that feeling.
Not always name it, but mostly, yes.
Not all, okay. But then you're not able to draw that back in.
Yeah, I can't do that.
like for instance in a coaching session where you then need to draw in a feeling when, so if you're creating anchors, things like that. So that can't happen. So what happens in you then? Just nothing.
Yeah, so well, I am a woman of a certain age. So, occasionally I'll have an emotion that I wasn't expecting when I'm watching a Kleenex advert or something. all of a sudden I'm
Yeah,
like, why
because your
did I
emotions
find
are
that
still
really
energy in
sad?
your body. They're
Exactly.
still there. So there's like a
Yeah.
disconnect, but
Can
of
be really
course they're
random,
still there.
hormonal producing emotions. But for me, it's I can pick up on somebody else's emotions. And so as a tip, if you're coaching somebody like me and you want to, let's say, create an energy for something, if you can create the energy, then I am more likely to feed off your energy and get and build the energy that way. But if
Absolutely.
you're
But that's good
asking me,
relational coaching, isn't it? That's great coaching. That's what that is, really, in essence.
exactly. But if you're asking me to recall, then it's unlikely to happen. So if you wanted me to anchor a really good, positive emotion with, a goal or with a managing a situation that comes around, and I want to change how I'm responding to it, then it takes work, and it takes a lot of work to get me to that place where I can create that anchor. And even then, I'm creating it off your energy, not my energy. I get there eventually.
And
It
does
can
it
be
work when you
difficult.
go back to test your anchor and use your anchor when you're not in the
Sometimes,
space?
not always. Because the other thing with the way that my brain works is sometimes I forget what the anchor was anyway. Just, that's what memory disorders do. But
Okay, so it all becomes quite difficult, I'm hearing. It becomes quite
it can be
difficult and
incredibly difficult. Yeah, it can be. And I think this is why when I learned more about all of these conditions, it was like a light going on that I suddenly had that realization of, so this is why coaching hasn't worked for me.
right.
This is
So I was going
why
to
I'm
open that
not getting
conversation.
there. And why? Because the challenge here being that I didn't know I had these conditions. I didn't understand myself enough
What
to know.
did you think was going on, Sassy,
I
when you were
just
having coaching?
yeah.
And you can tell me a little bit about the type of coaching that you were having and how you were feeling, to the best of your
Yeah.
ability to recall that,
Yeah.
about it and what you made
Yes.
that mean. Tell us a little bit about that experience.
I mean, what I found was a bit like you were saying about the with the meditations or any hypnotherapy that is very visual, go down the stairs and that kind of thing, would just leave me very flat, very frustrated, bit stressed, the opposite of the intention usually. From a coaching perspective, I would think, well, I, as a coach, have seen that powerful transformation. So why am I not getting it? It's either me and I'm rubbish, or it's the coach and they're just not very good. And that is what I used to think. It's either me, I'm just going to give up. The amount of times that I started like working with somebody and just said, this is just isn't working, and just I didn't go back. Or just got frustrated. What people tell me, people who have aphantasia, what they tell me is that the phrase I hear a lot is, I just went along with it. And that is sad. Now I know,
Tragic.
yeah, now I know, but this is what's
Did your
challenging
did,
for
can I just ask?
coaches.
I just got a question there, slightly offside, but the coaches that you were working with, did they not notice that?
I think that I remember having one conversation with one coach who was convinced I just needed to try harder.
Oh gosh, okay.
Because, and I, in a way, I get that. Because if you have used tools that have worked with everybody else, and there is that one person that it doesn't work with, then you're automatically going to think it's that person. And the reality is, it kind of was, but it was also that lack of knowledge and understanding from the coach. But how could they have understood and known something that even I didn't know and I had it? I think this is what's so challenging, that you're going to find, I'm sure, that anybody listening to this is probably sitting there thinking now, if you're a coach, thinking, oh, I do remember I had that client who really seemed to be struggling to kind of do the visualizations or look into the future, because that's another potential issue for people with fantasia. We can't see the future. We're very close, you know, when it comes to creating actions with us, they need to be very, very small steps, very close to us. Because if you try and plan anywhere too far into the future, it's something we can't get our brains to think about. And I'm sure that there'll be people listening thinking, oh, I wonder if, or that might explain why. And this is why, for me, the work that I'm doing, I'm really passionate about, because I know that there will be people who don't know that they have these conditions, because they're not widely known about yet, even though there are more of us than there are adults with ADHD. But people just don't know about it. And so if I can't, if I'm not able to reach the wide enough audience to let people know that they've got it, then maybe I can reach the coaches, and for the coaches to be able to think, ah, okay, this person is presenting to me as if they may have. I'm just going to ask a few more questions. Because I guess one of the biggest things is, how many times as a coach do you ask? I mean, you probably do because you can't visualize, but if you didn't know that you couldn't visualize, or you can visualize and didn't know that people couldn't, the first question you're going to ask somebody is not, can you visualize? Because everybody assumes that everybody can. But it's just a small question.
So
it can
going
have
back,
a massive impact.
Very interesting to me. So just going back a couple of steps to a coach, there's a very big difference, I believe, between a coach who has got a system and tools and things that work with, I'm doing air quotes now, other people.
Yeah.
And a bespoke, highly trained, well-qualified coach, specifically with NLP or other sensory understandings, who would be led by the client, who probably is very unlikely that any client with aphantasia, without even being discussed, would have a very visually led representational system.
But you say that, but then...
But let me finish. So it's unlikely that they would go fully on with that, but they might have the language to it. But working with them properly and deeply, it would become apparent, okay, with the check-ins and everything that I would do, that something was not happening in potentially the same neuro order that it might happen with somebody else. And so I think there's a difference between quality bespoke coaching that really works with you as a whole person, rather than someone saying, this is my way and it works for everybody else. I think you need to try harder. And I do want to pull that bit out, because try harder. We can't try harder. It doesn't actually even make sense. And it's language that, in my opinion, as a coach, should be absolutely eliminated. It's loaded there with accusation that it's you, Sassy.
Yeah, no, exactly.
I'm all right. My tools are good. You need to try harder. You either can do something, or you are doing, or you are not doing it.
Yeah. And if there's
trying
a barrier
harder
to it,
is a
find
very
out more
problematic
than,
language. Yeah.
I agree.
And so I think that whether you knew aphantasia or not, so for instance, I am not massively into labels. Or if somebody said to me, I am a client with a very specific diagnosis of ADHD and this is how I present, then I would decide whether that would be a good fit, because I know from some of the interactions I have with some clients that it's a very different world in there, okay? And I'd want to honour that properly. And it's a much slower world as well. It takes a lot longer, and it has to be very simple and linear, but then the way that that neurodivergence might think is not linear. So it all kind of gets in a big ball tangle. And I do understand that, but I think it's interesting to think about, as coaches, as you referenced that, who are we helping and how? And how do we adapt as well? Because, for instance, as an NLP coach, I wouldn't want to get into the labels. You know, now I would want to understand how somebody operated.
Exactly.
But for me personally, that's not it. But then there are some things that present. So if I knew I had a client that can visualize, then I'm going to be coaching in a very different way.
Absolutely.
So I could adapt to it. But it's I think it's just important to make that differential, because I don't think that sounded like the best experience that you could have had.
But then, I think when we had our conversation, and I said to you about when I did my NLP training a very, very long time ago, and this was before I even knew I couldn't visualize. I asked the question. I mean, I say it was before I knew I couldn't visualize. I'm guessing I must have had an inkling, because I asked the question, so how would this work with somebody who can't visualize? And I was told, and this was 2011, and I was told by the trainer, a master NLP practitioner, everybody can visualize. They just need to, it's like a muscle. You just have to work at it. You have to exercise it, but everybody can visualize. And of course, that may have been what people thought back in 2011, potentially. But there are still some people who think that. I was doing
some
research.
Well, it's a huge generalization for a start, which no NLP trainer should be using everybody. That pretty much covers 8 billion odd people. So it's a huge generalization.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, if you dig into it, there is the potential for that to be true.
Yes.
There is. However, it's not a very useful answer in the moment.
No. And there's,
especially
and
not for your training.
I was doing some research for on hypnotherapy. And because one of my clients had said to me that they'd heard about these hypnotherapists who, again, were very much of the view that everybody could visualize, and they had a cure for aphantasia. And and I said, okay, I'll go down that rabbit hole, so you don't have to. And I watched one of their videos, and it made me angry. As they were basically doing this whole video about how aphantasia, people can be, you know, fixed from having aphantasia. And then I thought, well, here's the thing. If you've developed it through dissociation and a trauma-related dissociation, then there is the potential to
be heal
able to
that.
Yeah. And I thought, after I'd calmed down a bit, I thought, well, they're kind of right in a way, because there will be people who have aphantasia now who weren't born with it, who have it as a result of dissociation and trauma, who will eventually be able to visualize again, potentially.
I'm feeling the word disclaimers coming up for me, because obviously,
exactly,
you know, this could be helpful for you is much better than I have the cure.
Yeah. And it was quite
Did you try it?
I thought, no, because it was all visual. It's just ridiculous.
It felt a little bit of paradox
was,
there, yeah.
Yeah, it was very much you clearly don't understand.
And it's a tricky one. I mean, you know, the thing is, ultimately, as coaches and healers and helpers in this world, we're all trying to help each other. And if we have suffered from something, the chances are that we want to try and help or use our tools that could help. But I think it's very careful with things like this and neurodivergency, how you position it, because it's really a very individual experience. And actually, I can never know your experience and you can never know mine. So we're only using this with language and communication, doing the best we can. But what have you tried? Have you tried, if anything, ways to change this? Since we're talking about, you know, different options, have you tried anything?
I kind of have got to 54 and realized if it hasn't happened already, it's probably never going to happen. And I
is that a no?
Well, I tried the open eye. There was one doing the rounds that if you just would stare at something and then close your eyes, you get the imprint of the image that you've been
All
staring
right, yeah,
at
like
on
when
your
the sun
mind.
burns your eyeballs when you look at
Exactly,
it.
exactly. So there was this whole thing doing the rounds. If you just do that every day, like multiple times a day, eventually it's going to trigger the bit of the brain that where visualizing sits to work.
So basically, the neuroscience of retraining your brain in a certain way
Yeah, but
concept.
it's completely different. Looking at something and having that imprint is completely different to the working on the
I
bit
don't
of
think that
the brain.
would work for
It
me.
didn't.
I
It
just
didn't.
tested it right now, just for a few seconds on my podcast microphone, and moved away to see if I could find it. And so I get the concept behind that though. And
Yeah.
again, like for some people, they could say, "Do you know what? I did this many, many
Yes.
times, and it brought it back." So we're all the
Lots of
same,
people are
but we're all
trying.
different.
Yeah, so lots of people are trying drugs and psychedelic based drugs. So particularly in America, where you can microdose, and things are more legal there than they are here. I mean, I know from my experience, I've had lots of operations in my life, and I'm actually allergic to quite a lot of sort of opium based drugs. And when they gave me tramadol once, I had the most amazing visualizations. And so I know that, but that's kind of not me doing it on purpose. I'm
No,
not
it's
consciously doing
induced. However,
exactly
it might argue that the capacity is there
different
to
part of the
produce
brain,
different
though.
parts.
I
Yeah,
think.
exactly, being stimulated. You
Yes,
can't be on
yeah.
tramadol for most
Yeah.
of your life just
Oh,
so you
but
can
I
experience
do.
stuff.
Yeah, but I dream very vividly, and I have night terrors. So I do have that time when I'm awake and asleep. So that hypnagogic state, that
What
is.
do you
So,
think about that, Sassy? The fact that you have night terrors?
oh, what do I think about it? I think it's a bit odd that I still have them as an adult. There are a few of us as adults that have them.
So you had them as a child.
No, you see, I have no memory of having them as a child. But
Would you
now,
say I still have them?
well, as an adult, because night terrors usually happen in childhood and then you grow out of them.
You don't remember having them in childhood.
But I don't remember having them in childhood. My mum
Does your
doesn't
mum
remember
remember?
me. No,
Right.
she doesn't remember me having them. So whether I had them, and she and I just have no
You
memory
don't
of
know.
them. Don't know, but I definitely have them now. So for me, it's a difficult one to answer, because there's a part of my brain that is massively curious about the fact that when I'm having a night terror, I know I'm awake, but I know I'm asleep. Like I'm in that state in between asleep and awake, and or awake and asleep actually, because it's the hypnagogic state. And I'm very conscious that I'm seeing things. And so that really, like, kind of scientific researchy bit of my brain gets very excited about, ooh, what's
Because
going
you're
on?
again in the in-between stage is what I'm
Yes.
hearing. The same as with the
Yes.
tramadol, it's like it's accessed an in-between, like a gateway,
Yes.
and in here I can visualize, which
Yeah.
again supports what was said. Everyone can visualize, or rather, the language might have been better. Everyone has the capacity to.
Yes.
Or the brain build too.
Yeah. Yeah.
And even the guy that had the operation, he could and then he couldn't. I wonder what happened to him, whether that was maybe that
He
was
still can't.
rewired. He still can't. So
Yeah.
that
Yeah. So
sounds like some
that's it.
damage done
That's
to
brain
a brain
damage.
area.
Yeah.
So we're
Yeah.
looking at like shutdowns and different kinds of. I
Yes.
wonder what neuroscience says about all of this. Very interesting, because night terrors. And I'm no expert on night terrors, and I have never had one, even though I've had a couple of grim nightmares in my life, like everyone. But I think that's a different thing.
Yeah,
And so
hugely
that
different.
is a message, isn't it, from the
Yeah.
body, like from your subconscious, like.
Night terrors are in the moment that they are happening, they are very real. So with a nightmare, you can wake up from a nightmare feeling, having an emotion. Say if something is very sad and it's in your nightmare, and you can wake up and be very,
You
sad
can
and
sometimes feel
upset.
like that for a few hours, can't
Yeah.
you? Or maybe the whole
But
day.
with a night terror, they've they've run some tests, and basically your body goes into full on fight flight.
Yeah, it's a big response.
Massive response. And I think I heard an expression once that it was, you know, the impact on the body of a night terrier is the equivalent of having just run a marathon. And from my experience, I know I have a night terror and that can affect me for days. I can be completely off kilter for days because I'm absolutely exhausted. And lots of people really hurt themselves when they have night terrors because you physically go into that. You know, some people have that capacity to actually move and do things. My husband's perspective, I just kind of twitch a bit. Although I did have one occasion where I threw myself out of the bed because I thought that night terrors often are somebody in the room with you, somebody attacking you, and things like spiders and things can be very real. Now, I'm actually not arachnophobic. I quite like spiders. I'm very interested by them, but they usually form one of those. And I can have my eyes open and they'll be crawling across my pillows. Sorry, arachnophobes listening to this. I do apologize.
I'm making a really weird face, but everyone that's listening. Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I apologize for any visual images.
Thanks for the anchor.
Yeah. Mike, that's the AFANT's power. We get to give people images that we can't see ourselves.
So I'm hearing a lot of, like, you know, what feels like traumatic imprints here and, you know, responses to that as well. And so a lot of these areas sound quite tender potentially for a lot of people. I know there's been some research drawn up and some studies sort of tentative, I feel, about the connection between aphantasia and trauma, but there's nothing solid around that. But everything that you're saying does seem to suggest that it's like chung, 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 chung. And then when you're, you know, shut down, and then when you're asleep, of course your subconscious is like, and it's coming up. So I can see how those areas potentially, when we talk about one of the reasons why, could be connected and it's forcing its way out because it will have to come out somehow. There's a whole nervous system thing going on, isn't there, as well?
Absolutely.
That's quite a deep area. But I wonder if I could ask you, what do you think would be different in your life if you could visualize? Like, what I suppose, what are your frustrations? I know you can't specifically answer that, I appreciate, but like, I suppose what I'm saying is, in a way, so what?
Well, exactly.
What's the problem?
So
with the problem.
So I think having never been able to visualize, it's a difficult one to answer. For people who have lost the ability to visualize, it has a massive impact on their lives, huge impact on their lives, because you have to relearn an awful lot.
If you've got the before and after like that guy, I imagine that would be notably the impact. But for yourself, one of the things I'm curious about is that you've said the coaching was difficult, and the impact of coaching being difficult meant what for you? I guess that you couldn't get where you wanted to get.
Yeah.
You know, it becomes frustrating. Like, what are the problems with that?
So from a personal development point of view, it was very frustrating. From now, I've learned about how my brain works and how the challenges that I face. I know that setting and keeping goals is challenging. Being motivated is challenging. When you're not able to hang a feeling on something, when you're not able to create that emotion, that excitement for stuff, that can be challenging.
The process of goal setting in its very self and what you do to take the steps can be challenging.
Well, so the process itself, of course, my little geeky brain is like, okay, I can map out a nice little action plan here, not very too far in the future.
Brilliant on paper. Yeah.
Amazing. And then I'm going to put that action plan somewhere and then it's out of sight and literally out of mind. That can be challenging.
It's a problem to not implement that.
Yes. Yeah.
Is it because of that connecting to the future thing? A goal is a future based thing.
Yeah.
And so you can say it. This is what I would like. Put the pin in the map. This is how we would get there. These are the steps. Yep. Brilliant. Geeky brain likes that. Can figure that out. However, what I'm hearing is that you're not really connected to
exactly
that goal.
I've got a really great example for you. I can get up on a morning and catch sight of myself in a mirror, because that's another thing for me. Unless I'm looking at myself, I don't have a concept of what I look like. I can describe myself to you. So my hair is brown, you know, my eyes are hazel, you know, I can do all of that. But I have no real concept of what I look like. And so I can walk past a mirror and suddenly catch sight of myself and think, Christ, when did that happen? When did you put on all of that weight? Really must lose some weight, walk past the mirror, and for about an hour afterwards be thinking, I must, I'm going to be really good. I'm going to be really good. And then that's gone.
Do you not see yourself in the mirror every day?
Yeah, but like I said, I forget what I look like.
Ah, okay. So
I
it's
don't have
right,
that.
I see.
And I have now, it's interesting because I had this conversation with one of the researchers at that's looking into aphantasia. And I said, I would be interested to know if there is any correlation between aphantasia and obesity for people who do not have that mind-body connection. Because not everybody with aphantasia is obese, and that's a fact. But there are aphants that I know that are exactly the same as me, that because there is no concept of what you look like, you can't hang on to that concept, that image of yourself, that you lend the motivation to do the things to help you to lose weight, go.
It sounds like quite the double bind to live in. And it, you know, the word that keeps coming up for me is that sort of disconnection.
It
must feel, or there's a sense of such disconnection. And so when you're trying to put goals into action, achieve things that are future paced, it's like, oh, I'm just wanting to do this. Like, it's all cut, chopped. It's difficult to connect the dots. It's difficult
and
to get
to
that flow.
Keep that motivation going when you have lost, you know, when you have disconnected from whatever this end goal is. Now, I love a spreadsheet, and I you know, I love an action plan. And I, when it comes to kind of very sort of statistical work based, so I'm a strategist, I write strategies. I love the research side of that. And, you know, and I have a window to deliver a strategy in a particular time, and I can chunk that down to this bit, you know, the research needs to be done here, and the writing needs to be done here, and the consultation needs to be done here, and all of that.
So
works.
It's less about,
but when it comes,
oh, where's my creative brain? I must try and do all these millions of things to tune into it, and more about working with your strengths, and this is, and doing more of what you are good at. Because sometimes we can spend a lot of time focusing on what we haven't got, what is absent, and trying to get that either physically or psychologically, emotionally. And we forget, well, actually, I have got all these other capacities, which are often a lot stronger. Like potentially, like when someone doesn't have one of their senses, others become more in tune. And it could be said the same for people who are neurodivergent. So in this group, that you kind of identify with, do you have, so you said that you've got, have you got your own coaching method around this, or
so I have,
are you working with coaches to help them to be better coaches with people that might potentially have this?
So
that was a very
so,
long sentence.
With at the Aphantasia Coaching Academy, what I'm doing is then teaching coaches about these conditions and how to recognize them in a client, because you may have a client who doesn't know they have them but has them,
and what to do with them, and what to then do,
so to be able to adapt methods to suit them depending on how many of them they have, what combination of these conditions they have. So I teach the science behind them, how they present, the conversations that you might want to be having with a client. Obviously, we can't diagnose people, that's not our job.
No,
but we can, you know, we can have those conversations about, you know, are you able
approach.
To visualize? And then I teach some tools. So, you know, you've got somebody who's a bit like me, who, you know, can't get that motivation. So how do you create that motivation? So I walk basically coaches through some steps that they can take, that to adapt the work that they do to fit people like me. And it's an adaptive approach, and that's literally what it is. And that's why I coach people who are all, I teach people who are already coaches. So I don't, I'm not teaching coaching.
No.
I'm just, it's the method. So it's the understanding of the condition, and the challenges that as a coach you might face working with a client, but also the challenges that the client might face.
It feels more like awareness and relational to me as well, you know,
definitely
how to relate better. And can you just, before we kind of bring today's very interesting conversation to a close, which we must do at some point, would you be happy to just share a couple of these kind of adaptive practices to give us an example of the sort of things that, so let's say, for example, a coach has realised.
Yeah,
pretty, and the client, because actually this might be quite a shock for the client. So this is the sort of thing that I'm thinking around as well. This might be a real piece, so we have to walk tenderly. But aside from that, aside from that, what things could help? A couple of points could you share with us?
Yeah, so definitely one of the things that that I recommend is, you know, asking those questions and just understanding first of all what the limitations are of your client's brain. That's the first thing. So
you, and why would you do that, do you think? How would you position that?
I would do that right, you know, at that chemistry meeting session, however you, the getting to know you, everybody calls them so many different things, but you know, that very first sort of conversation that you're having with them when you're learning about them, if you have an intake form, you can have questions on your intake.
What kind of question would you put on there that would specifically draw towards aphantasia?
So you can have something as simple as, I was just going to say, you can have something as simple as asking them to, you know, think about a cat. Can you, but you need to have met them and have had a conversation with them so they don't go,
I wouldn't be expecting that.
We've gone past medical questions and now you're asking me about cats. So, you know, make sure you've had a conversation and perhaps say to them, there, you're going to think they're a little weird. Trust me with this. I'm just trying to understand how your brain works.
I think as well, for me, the first thing that comes to my mind is like one of the questions that I always find out, and I spend not just the intake, not just discovery, but the first two or three sessions are going to be really about understanding the person.
Exactly.
And one of the things is like, whatever said problem is, what have you tried before? And
always.
What worked and what didn't? And I think that's probably the most natural coaching question.
Absolutely.
That could,
and I
position
would hope,
well from my perspective.
Doing that anyway, I would have think, I would hope.
I'm doing that with my head. I don't know how thoroughly some people do that, or how long they spend on personal histories. Obviously, from an NLP approach, I was talking to another coach and I talked about personal history take, and they're like, oh, we didn't learn any of that in our coaching. So they've done a really, you know, good, solid coaching program.
Yeah.
Absolutely no dispute on that. And I was like, wow. So that's how are you going to get into that? It's very strategic, it's very grow modelly. And the person was like, can you teach me some of this, like, you know, this whole personal history taking thing and everything? And I said, well, we could definitely do a session on that. But I was like, that does come from as well very much NLP world and coaching boundaries, say, well, we don't need that. But for me, I want all the story.
Yeah,
because I can hear the beliefs, I can hear the values. I don't need to have those explicit questions. When you tell me your life, Sassy,
yeah,
I'm going to be able to pull things out, reflect things back. And it really is just beautiful, beautiful work. And then when you work, you don't always need the content for specific pieces. But I think people's stories are important. And to hear the story of a client is the first thing that I want. Instead of saying, well, what do you think that your limiting belief is around this goal that you have? I mean, seriously, that's very unsophisticated coaching, isn't it?
And interestingly enough,
that's why I'm here in the, in the chair.
One of the things that I teach about is narrative therapy, is based around narrative therapy and getting the client to tell their story and not wanting to go quickly into coaching mode, to just be into listening mode and listening to that story.
It's all there.
Somebody like me who has SDAM, because my history is all stories. But if you keep me talking long enough, there is the chance that it will trigger some element of a memory, a snippet a little something, because my memories are in there. It's just, I don't store my memories in the same way as you do.
No.
It's just that I can't access them in the same way. They're in a filing cabinet. A filing cabinet, they're filed away like everybody else.
Don't know else's. Where the key is.
It's locked and I have no idea where the key is. And that's, but every so often, it just opens enough for a file, to a bit of a file or a, just pop out. And I realise that I'm talking in very visual language, which is what can be quite confusing with people who work with me, because they assume that because I'm very visual in my language. Yeah.
Externally visual, yeah. But your internals
are not internally visual.
A little different. But they are, it's almost like.
Is one of the tips, really.
Yes, I think that's with SDAM, makes sense.
Narrative therapy. Get talking, get them to tell their stories, get them to tell the stories that other people have told them about their life. Because that's, for me, my stories of my childhood come from my mum. They're her stories of me. And I am incredibly lucky that her stories of me are all lovely, you know. So I'm lucky in that respect.
Well, you are.
Yeah, yeah. Because I don't have any horrible memories of me as a child, because there are no horrible stories. I can tell you interesting stories about things that potentially would have been quite traumatic, like the first time my knee dislocated and I had to go in, I was in hospital and all of those things. But again, I'm going to very factually tell you all about them with no emotion, because there's no emotion linked.
How old were you when that happened?
Oh, so the first time my knee dislocated, I was probably, well, when did I have my first knee operation? When I was 14. So about 12. So I can very factually tell you the story of that day from other people's perspective of what happened that day.
And if I say to you, you know, how was that for you?
Well,
can you answer that?
Yeah, it's interesting, because I would say to you, I would say to you very factually again, my response to that is that I have a story of it being very painful, and I know it's very painful, because just thinking, you know my husband watches the football, and sometimes horrible things happen when they play football and they tackle, and if I see a knee that it looks like it might pop out,
I remember, we've all made that face, but
my body physically, I can physically remember the feeling of it. And that's another thing with another tip I was just going to say is, you know, often you might want to work with people's energies.
Yeah, somatically, everything.
Definitely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's the nervous system, isn't it? Yeah, going back to if the brain can't do its thing, we go to the body that holds everything anyway. And how do we work with that? So again, maybe not so much about labels, but really following those senses is so vital. What you've said, that you have a story that it was painful, but even then you're checking yourself saying, yeah, I know my story says that, but actually I could feel it.
Yeah,
something
just being on ice. I mean, I don't like going out when it's icy. I mean, I'm okay in snow, but when it's icy, if I don't have to leave the house, I won't leave the house, because all I have to do is a slight wobble and I can trigger a panic attack instantly. And even though there's nothing happening in my head in relation to it, it's my body absolutely remembers how painful it was, my knees dislocating, and they used to dislocate all the time.
Yeah,
and my body experiences it. And so,
knees are such an interesting area as well. So interesting in relation to trauma and where it's held. It's very interesting, all of it. And have you ever worked with a fully somatic or energy coach or person, like completely in the nervous system in that way?
No, not yet. It's kind of it's something that I'm really open to. When I had it's this kind of learning about my conditions and how they present. It has been a bit of a journey for me.
Absolutely.
Since discovering it in 2015.
Yeah, it's all new.
Yeah, and when I had my nervous breakdown a couple of years ago, and I was working with a therapist who, he and I think had both checked out by the third session, because he couldn't understand that I was telling him that I couldn't do the things that he wanted me to do. So he was getting, I think, a bit frustrated, and I was getting very frustrated that I had to keep repeating myself that, no, I can't tell you what my inner sassy is saying, because I have no access to my inner sassy. It was kind of, you know.
And therapists don't tend to have those tools always
to
take you there to able.
No.
So again, is a lot of tick boxes and ways and methods, especially,
yeah,
I don't know what kind
not
of
gonna
CBT.
Work with me.
No,
not gonna work
CBT
with me.
doesn't work with trauma so much anyway,
No.
or anything. I'm not suggesting
No.
that's what you're carrying, but
But I realized
it
I
just
was.
depends, doesn't it?
I realized that actually the energy of I very logically knew why I was feeling the way I was feeling and what the issues were, but what I couldn't access was what my subconscious was doing with regards
to. Sounds like that
this.
Was still a lot of brain work, though. So it's just not going
Exactly.
to work if you're trying to ask the brain to do it.
Yeah.
But again,
but I
you
realized
know,
I was doing lots of very somatic things. I was tapping. I was brushing. I took and when I realized that was when I kind of had that light bulb moment of actually a lot of the really good tools for people like me are going to be more somatic. They're going to be in the body.
100%. Because the night terrors, the nervous breakdown, there's so much held there that's
all
not able to discharge. And so that's quite a daunting experience potentially, but also it could be, you know, a revelation. I mean, maybe come back and do podcast two when you might have done some of that
when
work
I
and see
found,
what it, you know, see how that goes. But it's been absolutely fascinating. I mean, obviously, this, if anyone's listened to the end, you are an absolute rock star, because I've just seen how long we've been talking about this. But I do feel that if this is the sort of thing that catches someone's attention, it's what we want to know about, want to explore for ourselves. So how can people like start this journey of discovery? Or maybe you did mention the VVIQ, where someone could go and do an actual test.
You
I'll put that into the notes for anyone that's interested. I'll find the link.
And
what about connecting with yourself, Sassy?
So you can find me on Instagram, the Aphantasia Coaching Academy. Lots of videos on there where I talk about what the conditions are. But also relate it to me and my life as well, to make it a little bit easier to understand. There's information in my blogs on my website, which is either you can get to me through the aphantasiacoach.com or the aphantasiaacademy.com. And if you want to start somewhere, I've got a short masterclass, which is understanding aphantasia, which is kind of dipping your toes in, really. It's a little bit of science in there for anybody who likes to geek out a bit.
Right. Yeah, because it's good to understand and also reflect on these things. So we'll put all those links in the show notes for anyone that's interested. And all that remains is for me to say thank you.
And thank
for
you.
Such an insightful, interesting conversation to bring to the listeners for Coach. And I think it's very valuable as well. And it's certainly something else for us to all be thinking about.
Absolutely.
How we operate, as we're always continuing to get to know ourselves. And of course, you know, we don't know what we don't know.
No,
so
absolutely.
I found it fascinating. Thank you so much. And
thank
listeners,
you.
Thank you again for listening to the Coach podcast, for tuning in. And if you're not in the Coach community over on Facebook, please come in and join there if you're a professional coach. And every month we meet at Coach Connect, which is the membership. And you can come and network with us, of which Sassy is a member as well. She's in there now. That's how we met.
Yeah.
So you can come and network with me and other fabulous coaches the third week of every month. And you can head over to coach-magazine.com and find the networking tab, and you get a free visit for your first visit. So I'd love to see you there. And also come and connect with me, leave a review, anything that you want to do feedback wise. I'm a real person. I'd love to hear from you. So thanks so much. I'll speak to you all again very soon.